From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Today, an independent panel of scientists releases a report on PFAS contamination in Michigan.
As these chemicals are captured, there is a need to dispose of them in some way that doesn't put them back into the environment, either through incineration or other form of storage, so that we don't take them out of one media and put them in another.
A West Michigan woman wants tougher state oversight of amusement parks after her sister suffers a catastrophic injury on a go-kart.
For sure that I don't want to see this happen to other families.
And we hear from the retiring head of the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.
I don't know what jargon-peddling trendmonger came up with the idea of performance measures, but they have almost no relation to the actual work that individuals have to do every single day.
Hello and welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A panel of scientists convened by Governor Snyder says Michigan's standard for protecting drinking water from PFAS chemicals may not be strong enough. The Michigan PFAS Science Advisory Council released its report today, finding people could be sickened by long-term exposure to drinking water with two of the chemicals, PFOA and PFOS, below the federal advisory level of 70 parts per trillion. And that's the standard that Michigan uses. Dr. David Savitz joins us now. He's professor of epidemiology at the Brown University School of Public Health, and he chaired this science advisory panel. And we should remind everyone that these chemicals have been used in thousands of products, including firefighting foam. And there's so much we don't know about these chemicals, largely because there are hundreds of compounds that come under that umbrella of PFAS, right?
There are a number of factors, but that certainly is one of them. Maybe people are familiar with the fact they phased out production of some of the ones that had been used historically, PFOA and PFOS. But there are dozens of others in commercial use and hundreds of others found in the environment. And so we're still struggling with what to make of that and how to address those issues when it is a very wide range of individual chemicals.
What would you say is the conclusion of the report about the health effects from being exposed to PFAS compounds?
Well, I think we, again, that's been reviewed by other groups, and I think we were focusing really on the evidence that bears on current policy decisions. And we took a good look at the toxicology, the animal studies, and also the human studies, the epidemiology. And in finding that convergence, we at least expressed the concern that the current recommendation of 70 parts per trillion may not be adequately protective. So I think we tried to quantify that maybe more than some others have tried to do.
And to let everybody just understand, when we talk about that 70 parts per trillion, that's Michigan's current standard. It's the EPA's Lifetime Health Advisory. And that's Michigan's current standard for triggering a groundwater cleanup?
That's correct. And that's being reconsidered. And again, I want to be clear on this. We're not saying that we know that it's a major public health problem. We're not suggesting that there's an immediate public health crisis, but rather we're saying that the evidence does not provide reassurance that it's sufficient. It's a matter of interpreting what is admittedly incomplete, inconclusive data, but we do make our best judgment to call into question whether that's an adequate safety margin.
Certainly the groundwater contamination has gotten a lot of attention. What other ways did you find that we may be exposed to PFAS?
As you said, the contamination of drinking water supplies through the groundwater is still the major source, the one that's best documented. And I think we agreed and concluded that it's the one that calls for the most immediate attention. Another area that is of concern that we're still understanding is the use of biosolids on crops, which, again, plants can take up PFAS if the water source is contaminated, and also that can contaminate the groundwater, and that we know very little about these other pathways in the environment, and that's really a research priority.
And certainly, as I'm looking at the report, the sentence that stands out is there are no known natural environmental processes in water and soil that can completely destroy these chemicals. So we need help in remediation. What's the best advice this report offers?
You know, in terms of remediation, again, it's a technology issue, and we make some specific recommendations for the approaches to be used. But I think if I can give a general statement on that, it's to, first of all, consider the array of options, to consider whether they effectively remove the whole spectrum or just some subset of these chemicals. As we discussed, they are very different in their properties and maybe in their toxicity. And then also that this is, again, a frontier for development of more efficient methods. But I think also something that comes up is that as these chemicals are captured, there is a need to dispose of them in some way that doesn't put them back into the environment, either through incineration or other form of storage, so that we don't take them out of one media and put them in another.
When you think about where the state is now in responding to PFAS contamination, what would you say is the most important thing that is not being done that should be done?
You know, I want to give due credit on what is being done, which is really to come to grips with this issue, to understand where the sources are, to identify contaminated water supplies in a methodical way that few, if any, other states have undertaken. I think probably the biggest issue facing Michigan, and it's facing everyone else, is the development of remediation. Once you find, once you identify these contaminated areas, it's really the technology, and I know there's no magic solution, silver bullet here, but there really is, I think, a growing need for technology that can be used in an efficient and effective way to mitigate exposure when we find it from historical contamination.
Governor Snyder requested this report, this independent report that has been released today. So it, in a sense, the torch is being passed on to a new governor, some new lawmakers. What's the message? What do you hope they take away from this report?
I think the message is that as the information and knowledge is evolving, we do have a body of scientific evidence that is helpful, should be helpful in informing the right policy, setting the right policy, the optimal policy, and that I would hope they would continue the seeking out of scientific evidence as an important part of the input in reaching these policy decisions, which ultimately, of course, also need to account for the political concerns, the financial issues, the other priorities. But I think that this drawing on the scientific evidence, it's not over with this report. It needs to be an ongoing process and really, I think, applicable to so many other areas where it's been underutilized in the past.
There does seem to be efforts in the lame duck legislature to take actions that perhaps might weaken Michigan's response and weaken standards. As you watch this happening, how concerned are you?
Again, I think that there are reasons for concern with adverse health effects, even at the 70 parts per trillion level. And of course, at higher levels, those concerns become greater. And I use the word concern. It's not panic. It's not a public health crisis, but there is a legitimate concern. It's really a judgment of the margin of safety you want to build in, how risky you want to be, and how cautious and protective you want to be. And in our view, it is a need to be protective even below the level probably of 70 parts per trillion, and it only would become more of a concern if it gets higher than that.
Dr. David Savitz, chair of the PFAS Science Advisory Committee, appointed earlier this year by Governor Snyder, the report out today. Thank you so much for speaking with us on Stateside.
Thank you for your interest.
Brad Felver is a fiction writer and essayist. He teaches writing at Bowling Green State University. His debut collection of stories, The Dogs of Detroit, offers a grim but realistic appraisal of the Rust Belt. In this review of the book, John Freeman tells us the characters are deeply flawed, stoic beings situated on the fringes of the American middle class.
Unlike recent treatments of Rust Belt Americana, Felver's book eschews the romanticization of people and place. His themes of toxic masculinity and failure often transcend the story's settings. This book brims with memorable characters at odds with their environments and life situations, and a streak of fatalistic resignation haunts them all. For example, Polk, the young boy in the title story, is chasing the ghost of his dead mother through the streets of East Detroit. Felver's characters must make decisions, but they are not ultimately momentous ones. This isn't because life and death don't hang in the balance. It's just that these decisions are already interpolated by market and geographical forces much larger than the self. As a Midwesterner, Felver is aware of coastal attitudes toward quote-unquote flyover states like Ohio and Michigan. He explores this dynamic through the characters Gus, an Ohio furniture builder, and Ruth, a Boston intellectual and Ohio transplant. In a passage that both encapsulates Felver's fatalism and renders the universal experience of mourning poignantly, Felver writes, "Her father died in March, and his father died in June. They both realized then that the last traces of childhood were gone. She thought the wakes would be dramatically different, but they weren't. Hushed voices and hollow platitudes for rich people and poor people alike." Geographical and class differences abound, in other words, but the great human eventuality renders them absurd. The title of Felver's book is rather conspicuous. Detroit, especially in the last decade, where both ruin porn and revitalization narratives have proliferated, has grown into a giant symbol whose usage and appropriation has been rightfully contested. Felver's book, thankfully, operates along neither of these polarities, urban decay on the one hand or Pollyanna-ish optimism on the other. Felver doesn't romanticize the emptiness of the east side of the city, nor does he gloss over the troubling realities created by redlining and deindustrialization. In a refreshing way, he resists the urge to assign his ideas to the city. Instead, he relies on descriptive prose and characterization to allow the readers and characters to explore the setting on their own terms. The feral dogs of Detroit are the stuff of myth. Felver clearly knows this. He knows there is a real place buried beneath what the city and the Rust Belt have come to symbolize, and the stunning images in this collection serve as an insightful approximation.
That was writer John Freeman reviewing The Dogs of Detroit by Brad Felver. Still ahead, one family's tragedy raises the question, just how safe are Michigan's amusement parks? That's in 20 minutes right here on Stateside. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Just off Highway 41 outside Marquette, there's an old man who lives alone in a small one-bedroom house. Most days you'll find him upstairs sitting at his desk or downstairs in his workshop. And there he makes some of the best tobacco pipes in the world. Interlochen Public Radio's Dan Wonshera traveled to the UP to bring us this profile.
Give me your title. Introduce yourself. Who are you and what do you do?
My name is Lee Irk. I am a tobacco smoking pipe maker. I live here in Nagani Township.
Lee is 78 years old. He's sitting in his living room, smoking a pipe. A lamp fills the small space with a warm incandescent glow. Pipes are all over the place, on every surface. Lee says there's at least 100 in the room.
Never started out to get to where I am today, but here I are.
And where are you?
Well, I'm considered one of the better pipe makers in the world.
I definitely put Lee in the master of pipe category.
That's Alan Boyd. He's the president of a Chicago pipe club that hosts the largest pipe show in the world.
In my opinion, Lee's probably in the top 15 or 20 pipe makers, period, alive or not.
In the late 1950s, Lee Irk was stationed in France. He was a clerk for the U.S. Army. They rationed cigarettes monthly, so smoking a pipe was the next best and cheapest option. Lee took to it. Back stateside, he began a career as a professional dog handler. He crisscrossed the country, going to prestigious dog shows. But after 25 years, Lee's body just couldn't take all that wear and tear. Then he heard about a guy in Minnesota selling a pipe repair business. Lee bought everything from him for about $1,500.
He moved all the equipment to Marquette and spent 10 days with me. He had a big box of just cheap pipes, and we'd do something to them, break them somehow or something, and he'd show me how to fix them and whatnot.
Lee did this for a number of years, but pipe repairing is repetitive work. He started to get bored with it. So he decided to make his own.
Furnace may turn on. So, here's where the magic happens.
Lee's workshop is downstairs. It's dusty and has tools scattered about the room.
Now, this looks like organized chaos, doesn't it, to you? But I know where everything is. I can find stuff in here. I can reach in these bins in without even looking.
One of the pipe designs Lee is famous for has a tall, tapered bowl. The pipe has precise ridges shaped into it, almost like the curves of a Ruffles potato chip. It makes the whole pipe design look kind of spiraled, even though it's not.
He's very meticulous, just a stinker for detail.
Again, Alan Boyd.
That's just Lee, and he won't let a thing out of his shop unless it meets his standards, and I think his standards are higher than everybody else's.
When somebody walks in the room smoking my pipe, you can tell across the room. There's no question.
Lee is careful to say he's not a pipe carver, but a pipe maker. He uses a saw, a drill press, and a lathe to make his pipes. And they're made out of blocks of briarwood he buys from Italy.
Once I get a piece, I start drafting on it to see if it's going to fit. All right. I've been looking at this piece of wood since 2012.
Another pipe Lee is known for is called a C pipe. If you look at it from the side, the bowl looks like the letter C, almost like the shape of an apple if you were to take a bite out of it.
How much do your pipes sell for?
They start at $7.50.
Lee lights his pipe and takes a few puffs.
And go up from there. Way up from there. A long way.
Then he points to an amber brown pipe on his desk.
It's $2,500.
Lee makes around 50 pipes a year. He says making them doesn't feel like work, but he usually tries to put in an 8-hour day.
When three things go wrong in a row, bing, 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 off go the lights and I get out of here.
Why is that?
Well, the briar gremlins are here. You got to get away.
Lee Irk sells his pipes all over the globe, China, Russia, Romania, Italy, Sweden. He recently got back from a trip to Japan where he sold all 12 of the pipes he brought with him.
I don't have any children, but I do have pieces of me all over the world.
Sometimes, when he works especially long and hard on a pipe, Lee can't bear to send it off into the world. So, he keeps it. For Stateside, I'm Dan Wanshura.
Lee Irk is a central character in a new documentary film about pipe smoking. Go to michiganradio.org to the Stateside page and you'll learn more about the film. For the past 12 years, supporters of the arts in Michigan have had a passionate advocate in Lansing, because that's how long John Bracey has served as director of the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs. He is retiring December 28th, so it seems like a good time to get his take on the state of arts and culture in Michigan. John, welcome. I'm wondering, as you think back over these 12 years, what was your personal goal every day when you'd go to work? How do you view your role as the director?
That's a great question, Cynthia, because it's changed. It's absolutely changed. When we went through some really tough times, like most of the state did, and we're nearly eliminated. So my goal during those years—
Keep the doors open and the lights on.
It was basically survive.
Yeah.
You know, how do I convince policymakers to continue to have faith in us and survive, especially when there's a governor in office who wants us to be eliminated. So those were difficult years. But the mission that I've always felt that we have, which is to provide access, I take that very seriously. And so I would say the goal that I have, even during those years, was what can I do for arts and cultural organizations so that they can provide access to their citizens and make their one square mile of the universe the best place that it can be. And that's what I think about every single day.
When I say those words, the arts, or I say cultural affairs, what does that mean to you?
Sure. Well, we have a really broad definition. You speak with folks and you hear the arts, and they immediately, and because the arts are really venerated in a lot of ways in terms of the fine arts. You know, they think of the great painters, the great musicians, et cetera. And that's the way that it should be. But when I think about the arts and culture, I think about all of those organizations that have as their mission creativity and teaching kids to express themselves, teaching individuals how to find a way to understand what it is to be someone else, to walk in someone else's shoes, to provide families in a city a chance to go out and meet their neighbors, to have fun with their kids and do those activities that arts and cultural events involve. That's how we think about it. And then, and we're very broad, as I said. I mean, of course, we work with the DIAs of the world, UMS, Meyer Gardens. They're amazing places. But we also work with the Copper Country Suzuki Festival, the City of Ironwood and the work that they're doing at the Ironwood Theater, or the Dowagiac Dogwood Festival. You know, those kinds of things that are so important to their communities that you just have to love what they do. We work with the science centers. We consider that cultural affairs. The zoos. The Detroit Zoo is doing, it's not just over a million people that visit it and see those exhibitions that they do. The research that they do there is amazing. And
the public never sees that.
No, but, yeah. No. They see the frogs, mm-hmm. but they don't understand the research that they're doing with those frogs, which is, I know, it's incredible. So it's a really, really broad definition for us.
And when you think of the state funding the arts, mm-hmm. what would be lost if it didn't?
Access immediately. Besides some organizations going away, you would lose access. And let me bring it really close to home for you, Cynthia. Mm-hmm. If government isn't funding the arts, public broadcasting is in a world of hurt. And in some areas of the country, and I've done a lot of work nationally, mm-hmm. But not just there, but in more remote rural areas, even in Michigan, sometimes public broadcasting is the citizens' access to arts and culture. And, you know, I can really get off on a tangent with this because I feel very, very strongly about it. You know, years ago, back in when the UNESCO charter was being created in the 40s, right? If you look at...
we're talking United Nations.
Yeah, the yes. United Nations. Don't hold me to this, but I think it's like Article 27 or 28 or somewhere in that area. They established a citizen's right to access to arts and culture as a human right. And to me, when you sign on to something that becomes international law, that says that there's a responsibility then that falls directly on the shoulders of that government to help provide that access to their citizens, because it is an absolute human right. I feel that very strongly.
As you cited the Great Recession, the very, very hard times in Michigan, there's been a sense out there that, well, that's the icing on the cake. Mm. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. What were those struggles like? You know, that we can cut the arts funding. We need to keep the lights on. We need to keep, water,
sure.
the basic services.
Sure. Well, Cynthia, some of that was our own fault in terms of the broader field of arts and culture, because we don't always tell our story real well. And justifiably so. I mean, I don't fault them for this. They're looking at the next exhibit. You know, it's a theater group saying the show has to go on. What's the next show? Without thinking that, you know, we need to tell our policymakers what we're doing in their district that's helping kids. We had 700 kids go through here last year to see, you know, an exhibit at the museum. That lack of communication with policymakers and the citizens in a more broad sense leads to that kind of thought, because it's completely a fallacy. It's an absolute need There are jobs involved. I think just our clients alone, and we don't represent the entirety. I mean, we don't do anything with the for-profit organizations. Mm-hmm. It's all not-for-profit, but we represent about 17,000 full-time employees. And I always get upset, too, because connected to that sort of, this is a frill, we don't really need it. And then this has always been a struggle for me throughout my career, too. But you think about how the arts relate to other sectors. I mean, just tourism alone. You look at tourism and cultural tourism across the state is almost a $2 billion out of the is it $10 billion, $19 billion? I forget exactly mm-hmm. what the tourism economy is, but it's like—
Big chunk.
Arts and culture is almost 20% of that amount. And that says something. You know, when we ask arts and cultural organizations to report on their final reports to us, mm-hmm. of course, you know, what their attendance was. You know, the individuals benefiting. It's usually somewhere between 25 and 30 million people walking through the doors of these organizations. And that doesn't even count the Arbitron numbers that you guys have. We don't count broadcast numbers. If we did that, it would be enormous. And you start comparing that to other sectors, and you start seeing that, wait a minute, this is huge. In and of itself, it's huge. You really shouldn't have to justify supporting arts and culture by its economic impact, any of those things, it in and of itself is worthy of support. And that doesn't even get into the education side of thing or how you help to make better citizens in your state and the role that arts plays in that from the time preschool until, you know, it's lifelong learning.
And starting those seeds early.
Yeah.
When you consider the fact that you've been 12 years now as director of the Michigan Council for Arts mm-hmm. and Cultural mm-hmm. Affairs, as you prepare to retire, what's the state of the state when you talk to Arts and Cultural Affairs? How healthy is it? What kind of, what do you see for the future?
I have such mixed feelings about that, you know, in my involvement. In 2002, the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs had $26 million to grant statewide. We had a staff of 10 and a couple of other, like, part-time, so it was like 12 people working there. 2010 came around. We had $1.7 million to grant, and at times, I was the employee. Mm. For the most part, we had two people there.
Lean years.
Yeah, it was really, really tough. But times change.
So where are we today?
We're at $10.7 million to grant today.
Not where you were back at the beginning of the century.
Hence the mixed feelings. Mm-hmm. You know, there's always a thought in state government that if you lose money, you don't get money back. Mm-hmm. We've proved that wrong. I feel really good about that. I feel good that we now have seven people working to serve the state. I feel really good about that. I feel a little bit like a failure when I look at we only got 10.7 back.
So challenge for your successor. Who will be?
Absolutely. Oh, she's amazing. I've known her since she was an intern. Mm-hmm. So it's been like 20 years. Her name is Allison Watson. I cannot be happier that they chose her. She's been the programs manager for the Arts Council for the last 7 years. What an amazing choice. The whole team there, it's by far the best staff in state government.
So December 28th comes, you retire. What, when you wake up in the morning of the 29th, will you not miss?
I won't miss.
Go ahead.
I will not miss performance measures. I don't know what jargon peddling trendmonger came up with the idea of performance measures, but they have almost no relation to the actual work that individuals have to do every single day. I won't miss having to deal with that.
And no more fights with the legislature and the governor's office.
Yeah, you know, I love those guys. I love those guys, though. And they've been so supportive over the last 8 years. The legislature, both chambers, have completely understood now, I think over the last years, the impact that the arts and cultural organizations have on their districts directly. And part of that is because the organizations are much better at letting them know what they're doing, sending the thank you letters that are so very important. And we started informing them more clearly about what our processes really are. Cynthia, you know, you hear all the time about transparency in government. The Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs actually lives that. We don't make funding decisions ourselves. We put peer review panels together, so it's other arts and cultural professionals reading the grant applications that are based on our guidelines that tell us these are good, strong organizations. We put that funding plan together. The Governor's Council, which is 15 people that get appointed, they look at those funding plans and make those final funding decisions. Then we make the awards. The kicker is we do that in public. All the panels, every single panel is open to the public. We also broadcast it, like on a GoToMeeting kind of thing, so organizations can learn the good and the bad and the ugly about their grant as well as everyone else's. When the legislators started figuring out that we're doing that, they started really paying attention, because what a great way to, you know, send taxpayer money back to taxpayers in their home districts. They've loved it. I think it was a huge factor in the fact that we weren't eliminated, was that we have that process, and they really appreciated it.
Well, wrapping up 12 years as director of the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs, John Bracey, it was a pleasure talking with you, and thank you for all you've done for the arts and culture in Michigan.
I've been proud to be their civil servant.
And a note, the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs is a financial supporter of Michigan Radio. Stay with us. You are listening to Stateside from Michigan Radio. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. It was supposed to be a day of fun at AJ's Family Fun Center near Grand Rapids. It was August 2015. Rachel Gibbs was wearing a scarf for the unusually cool day. She got into a go-kart. No staff member said anything about her scarf. The go-kart zipped off, and then Rachel's scarf got caught in an axle. Her windpipe was snapped. The horrific accident left Rachel severely brain damaged without higher brain function. Today, she's in a long-term care center outside of London, less than an hour from where her husband and her two sons live. This accident has turned Rachel's family upside down, and her sister, Corey Sandwick of West Michigan, has turned into a crusader for amusement park safety, especially since AJ's continues operating as it did before the accident, despite several apparent breakdowns in safety and precautionary procedures. Corey Sandwick is here with us now. Corey, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you.
Now, you say, Corey, that AJ's was unprepared for such an accident, and you feel that that lack of preparation delayed treatment for your sister. I know you were there on the day of her accident. Could you give us some sense and some examples of what you saw?
Well, the first one was nobody stopping the remaining go-karts on the go-kart track that day after my sister had actually been able to unbuckle her seatbelt, stop her go-kart, unbuckle her seatbelt, and get out. Stand on the track. There was actually a bystander that came over that knew CPR, that took control of the scene. And there weren't phones either within the vicinity to call 911. My brother-in-law happened to have his cell phone on him, so he dialed 911 from his British cell phone. And when he got the person on the call from AJ's to give the address, they weren't sure of the address of the facility either.
So no staffer able to do any kind of first aid or any kind of CPR, no phone nearby, and the staffer didn't know the address of AJ's.
Correct. And there wasn't an AED on site or even just a first aid kit that came out to the go-kart track or that was near the go-kart track.
Okay. And of course, we're talking about the external defibrillator device that is recommended to be in public places for traumatic moments. So following your sister's accident, what kind of investigation, what kind of action was taken by the State Licensing and Regulatory Affairs Department, the body in Lansing responsible for regulating amusement parks?
My understanding is that a state inspector did come out to inspect the go-karts, to look at their mechanical operation, to make sure that there wasn't anything mechanically that had actually caused the accident. And once they inspected that portion of the go-karts, the AJ's was allowed again to run go-karts with less than 24 hours after Rachel's accident.
And to the best of your knowledge, Corey, was AJ's fined? Was it forced to make any changes? Was there really any repercussion from what happened to your sister?
To the best of my knowledge, no. There was no repercussions. They weren't shut down. They weren't fined. I have learned, to the best of my knowledge, that in my conversations with LARA, which is the Licensing and Regulatory Affairs Agency that oversees amusement parks in the state of Michigan, amusement parks are permitted and not licensed. So being permitted places a limit on them as to how they can impose penalties on them. Mm-hmm. They can shut down rides or pull and deny an amusement park's ride permit, but they can't actually fine them for not complying.
And I know since your sister's accident and you've really become a crusader for amusement park safety, you found some unsettling trends about oversight and about regulation of amusement parks throughout the entire country. So let's start with, how does the federal government handle this oversight and regulation of amusement parks? What'd you find?
Actually, there is very little federal oversight across the U.S. It is left up to each state to come up with their own standards. We have found that there are states that actually have no standards. That is not the case in Michigan. We do have a law called the Carnival Safety Amusement Act in Michigan, but other states do not have any sort of regulation around amusement park rides.
And when I stop and think, just right off the top of my head, I can think of a couple of horrifying accidents at amusement parks elsewhere. The Kansas Water Park 2016, where the 10-year-old boy was decapitated. There was the Texas roller coaster, a woman fell to her death. That was, I believe, 2013. So it's interesting that with those kind of dramatic accidents that there hasn't been some kind of a push to do more nationally. So it's up to the states. So what's in the state law, the Carnival Amusement Safety Act here in Michigan?
Well, there is within the state law, there is a reference to an ASTM standard. ASTM is a national body that sets regulations and makes recommendations. They don't make laws, but they make recommendations and standards around many things that we come into contact with as consumers. But one of them is specifically the ASTM F24 Committee on Amusement Parks.
So I want to make sure I get this right. These parks in Michigan are permitted. They're not licensed, so there's no license to pull. And the law, in effect, basically said, well, here's the suggested procedures that you should follow. But it seems like tell me if I'm wrong here, there's not a lot of teeth behind that. There's no or else.
Correct. So in the current law in Michigan, there is a reference to the ASTM standards, which actually does have safety procedures written into it. But it's my understanding from LARA that they are limited in how much inspections that they can do, partly based on the fees that are generated. They actually have told me that there's not enough fee generation within the permitting process to actually check that safety standards are in place at amusement parks. Mm. The main thing that they're going out to inspect is the mechanical equipment. I don't want to downplay the importance of inspecting those things, but there is also a portion of the law that's in place that they're not able to enforce.
And so what kinds of steps have you seen, Corey, from the American Society for Testing and Materials, the ASTM? They've reacted to what happened to your sister?
Yes, they've got a vote going through currently looking at requiring covers on the rear axle of go-karts to cover the tires. That is only to address new go-karts right now. Mm-hmm. But they are aware of the fact that these were existing go-karts that were in place, and they do plan on taking up a vote to address existing go-karts. Once the ASTM does that, assuming that passes, I will be going back to my representatives again to get the reference to ASTM updated in the Carnival Safety Amusement Act law.
Here in Michigan. Yeah.
Yes.
If you've just joined us, I'm talking with Corey Sandwick. Her sister was severely injured in an accident at AJ's Family Fun Center near Grand Rapids in the summer of 2015. A scarf that she was wearing got caught in an axle of the go-kart, and it snapped her windpipe and left her severely brain damaged. And just going back to that day, did anyone say anything about the scarf at all as your sister got into the go-kart?
No, actually, nobody did. And my mom was with us as well. It was my mom, my brother-in-law, my sister, and four of our kids. My mom actually had a scarf on that day as well. So there were two people that got on the, out of eight, that got on the amusement, on the go-kart rides with their scarves on that day.
And in your investigations, there was a 2007 internal memorandum from the park to its employees. Can you tell us what's in that?
Yes, it's a memorandum to the employees that is outlining what AJ's Family Fun Center saw as their, that they're an at-risk park. And what that means is that if anybody that is going on to their site is taking a risk. So if somebody comes up to them and claims that they've been hurt, the AJ's employee is meant to say nothing about it in regards to them getting hurt on their site. Even not necessarily offering a Band-Aid initially, or perhaps offering a free slushy instead.
So after this horrific accident, what kind of contact has your family had with the park?
We have not had any ourselves. There was a lawsuit that was eventually settled at the time, but no direct contact from AJ's.
I know you've been working with State Representative Thomas Albert, the Republican rep for District 86, hoping to shore up enforcement and oversight of amusement parks. And he has drafted legislation, but what's the problem here?
The problem, as he sees it right now, is the lack of being able to increase the funds to be able to support a position that would allow for the inspection of the safety standards. Laura has said without increased funding that they wouldn't be able to support a bill that would strengthen those regulations or inspections. Alternatively, we have discussed coming up with a standard similar to something that North Carolina has in place currently, which is a Gold Star safety standard, which would be a voluntary program for amusement parks to participate in. They would be able to have a symbol, you know, on their facility or near the amusement rides that would show that their safety standards go above and beyond others. So it would be a consumer awareness campaign as well as something for amusement parks.
So because I think you've told us Representative Albert doesn't think his bill would get out of committee right now.
Correct. Yeah.
All right. So this idea of this Gold Star safety standard, it seems like a start.
Yes, it does. In my mind, I'm in the construction industry, and standards like LEED and Energy Star have done a lot to push our building codes to get better. So my hope is that it would be this Gold Star safety standard would be something similar to that, that we can start to increase awareness around the need for safety standards among, again, consumers and amusement parks, and then eventually perhaps adopt that into law.
What keeps you in this fight, Corey?
My sister, for sure, that I don't want to see this happen to other families, and my two nephews. I'd like to be able to let them know what we've done as a result of this. I can't change what happened to their mother, but hopefully we can make a difference going ahead.
Corey Sandwick, we want to thank you so much for speaking with us.
Thank you for taking the time.
And now we turn to GOP Representative Thomas Albert of the 86th District in West Michigan. Representative Albert's been working with Corey Sandwick on possible legislation to shore up gaps in amusement park safety in our state. He spoke to us from the floor of the Michigan House. Representative Albert, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thank you, Cynthia. I really appreciate the time.
Why did you decide to join forces with Corey to take up this cause?
Well, you know, I guess first off, you know, I just feel some deep sympathy that her family went through. And, you know, I had some office hours in my district, and Corey came and talked to me, and we did a deep dive into the issue a couple of times, actually. And I think we may have found somewhere where we might have a path forward to try and improve the safety at some of our amusement and carnival parks here in the state of Michigan.
So tell me, what's currently in the drafted legislation?
Well, we don't have anything drafted quite yet. We have to talk to all the stakeholders first. One thing you don't want to do in the legislative process is jump the gun and start talking about proposed legislation too early, because you might kill the legislation before you get started. So we're taking it slow. We're going to make sure we get it right.
So what do you want to accomplish and tackle with the legislation as you consider what you want to put into this bill?
Well, you know, I think I'm in kind of a unique position. You know, I have the Ionia Free Fairs in my district. I have the Kent County Youth Fair. So I have two county fairs in my district. And, you know, I have three kids. We love going to the fair, and we just want to make sure when we go that everyone in the community has a safe place that they can go. The one thing we don't want to do is we don't want to come down with a heavy hand and over-regulate and basically prohibit these businesses from being able to offer a good time for families to go enjoy in the summer.
What kind of ideas are you formulating as far as what you're striking this balance between, you know, not shoving businesses out of business, but you also want to have them, you know, be safe?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a bit of a balance, but, you know, working with Corey and talking to her and looking at what other states do, I think what we've found is North Carolina has it's more of an incentive program where if a business wants to participate, it'd be voluntary, but they can enter into almost like a Gold Star program where if they have good safety programs and training programs for their employees, it can be regulated by, in the case of Michigan, regulated by LARA. So it would just help businesses volunteer to improve the safety at their locations, and then they could put stickers on their entrances and on their website saying that they're, you know, a safe family environment.
As you were kind of digging into this, and I know in talking with Corey, we became aware that in our state, amusement park rides are permitted. They're not licensed. So that kind of limits LARA in the actions it can take, doesn't it?
Yes. Yep, precisely. So in Michigan, it's not like there's no oversight. Like, for instance, the location where Rachel Gibbs had the incident, there was an inspection not too long before that, and the equipment was actually came and inspected by LARA, and it was deemed to be, you know, all in compliance with the relevant rules and acts that are currently in place here in Michigan. So it's not like there's no regulation, but, you know, it just this tragedy occurred, so We got to try to make it safer here in the state of Michigan.
Corey tells us that the current Michigan laws do reference safety standards from the American Society for Testing and Materials, but the licensing and regulatory affairs is limited in the ability it has to inspect and enforce because of lack of funding. It makes you wonder, why is there a law on the books but not the money to enforce it?
Well, that's a good question. That's where I said, you know, we've done a deep dive into this a couple times, and that's where you get into a bit of the nuances of what's the difference between a permitting process and the difference between a license. I'm still investigating, you know, what the implications are of that distinction. So we're working on it. We're seeing what we can do to improve the safety here for our parks here in Michigan. But, you know, I'm more of the mentality and the philosophy that, you know, I think we can do a really good job of incentivizing good behavior, and I think we'll get a lot better result that will ultimately make these locations safer.
State Representative Thomas Albert, we want to thank you for taking time with us, talking to us from the floor of the Michigan House right here on Stateside.
Thanks, Cynthia.
We reached out to AJ's Family Fun Center for a comment on this story. They did not respond to our request. And we reached out to the Department of Licensing and Regulatory Affairs, LARA, with specific questions about the department's oversight of carnivals and amusement parks in Michigan. LARA confirmed that as the administrator of the Carnival Amusement Safety Act, the department permits and inspects individual amusement park rides. They do not license amusement park operators, and they do not inspect park safety procedures. And as for funding, LARA wrote that the revenue it generates from permitting and inspection is, and I'm quoting here, insufficient for the administration of the Carnival Safety Amusement Act. As a result, Lara wouldn't recommend supporting any future legislation that would increase oversight without an increase in revenue generated by permitting and inspection. You can find the full response by going to the Stateside page at michiganradio.org. And that's Stateside for today. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you for listening.